Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, Episode 149, Michael A. Stackpole, The Future of Bookstores, and Controversy.
This episode is brought to you by The Crystal Bridge, a novel from Charles M. Pulsiver that blends science fiction with just a dash of fantasy. Caden is a typical teenage boy, except he can open wormholes to faraway worlds. His first trip almost killed him. He's been afraid to try another. Erin is far from the typical teenage girl. She has the ultimate gift of empathy, seen into the memories and souls of others. Her gifts make her different and lonely, despite how close it brings her to those she knows. When these two meet, the existence of two worlds will be endangered as their abilities plunge them into a planet of war. Their adventure may tear apart multiple universes, or they may just save us all. Charles M. Pulsiver lives in St. George, Utah with his lovely wife and neurotic dog. He writes sci-fi and fantasy in the occasional zombie guide because he is obsessed with surviving the zombie apocalypse. While The Crystal Bridge isn't about zombies, it does feature tons of adventure, intrigue, peril, and, well, did I mention wormholes? Wormholes are cool. Please visit Charles' blog at noticeyourworld.blogspot.com and visit our website so you can click on the image for The Crystal Bridge.
It's basically about the business of writing, and they tell you the stuff they wish that someone had told them when they got started as writers.
You know, somebody can be a successful marketer and not necessarily provide a quality product.
I'm going to let Moses go because he's frothing at the mouth to talk about this one.
I like writing. I like reading. I like to immerse myself in books. So that seems like a pretty good career choice.
Domo arigato, Mr. Roboto.
Oh, you sound terrible. What happened? I'm just kidding.
Oh, man.
And now, podstructed on a zeppelin by an apprentice mage and delivered by rocket ship to a benevolent dragon, Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing.
Welcome to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, your podcast for science fiction and fantasy literature. This is Moses Sirigar.
And this is Brent Bowen.
And we're Sean Farrell.
We're without our fearless leader. Heaven forbid the brother's got to go out and do a little real work, you know?
Yeah, it kind of feels like your dad giving you the keys to the car for the first time, doesn't it?
It does. The boss is away.
Uh-huh.
The two of us will play. And a good episode to play with, too, because this one's got, it's all sorts of fun. We're going to have all sorts of problems with this one, aren't we?
Yeah, we're going to be very careful. Sean, sorry about all the empty beer bottles around and all the marks we made on the furniture from having our feet up and just for kind of going off the rails a little bit. But no, we're just kidding. We do have some things to discuss. And as we mentioned in the previous episode, we're going to talk to Michael A. Stackpole, who we did talk to a year ago. We had a fairly epic conversation with him about ebooks. And so we're going to talk to him and see where he's at 1 year later. As I mentioned to him in the interview, he has now developed a reputation as an evangelist. And he laughed at that when I told him that. that's where he's coming from, right? He's a big proponent of the new waves in publishing, digital publishing and electronic self-publishing, getting backlist up in ebooks. And there was at least a little bit of controversy around some of his comments that he's made about this. And it mainly stems from a term that he's used. He's used on his blog, stormwolf.com, where he's used the word, quote, house slave, to refer to people who are, who think that, you know, all they can do is go with a traditional publisher. And, you know, not unsurprisingly, this terminology has offended some people. I don't know quite how many, but there's been a little bit of back and forth on Twitter. Our friend of the show, Tobias Bakel, you know, was kind of, you know, maybe having a little argument on Twitter about this with some folks as well. And the background of it is that this recently appeared on J.A. Conrad's blog when Barry Eisler wrote a guest blog post. He referred to the mindset that Michael Stackpole has referred to as a, quote, house slave mentality, and, you know, feel uncomfortable even just saying it. But, you know, this came out, J.A. Conrath, his blog is really big, so, you know, that terminology came back into consciousness for some people. And on his blog, there was a lot of, like, sort of arguments about it back and forth. and I heard some of it got pretty ugly. I didn't read all the comments. I'm kind of have steered away from that for the time being. And, you know, we don't usually talk about controversial stuff, but one of the reasons that I feel like we should talk about it is because there is a really good debate or topic underneath this unfortunate wording, perhaps. You know, I mean, you'll see in the interview later, I'm going to ask Michael, you know, if he meant to cause controversy, what he would say to people who were offended by the use of the term. And so we'll let him speak for himself as far as, you know, those comments. But as you've been aware of this going on, Brent, have you had any thoughts about it?
I have, just because I'm wondering why we feel it necessary. The only reaction I've had, the main reaction I've had, is wondering why we feel like we, as authors, and I'm speaking in kind of a community sense, why certain authors feel like they have to elicit some sort of strong reaction. I think most of the industry has woken up to the realization that that the industry's changing dramatically. And in large measure, I know a couple episodes back, you know, you and Sean talked about the future of bookstores and the ebook discussion and the 80%. And so it's surprising to me that, one, we're working so hard to elicit a response when I think pretty much everybody that's plugged into the industry's got a sense that the world's changing dramatically. The other thing too about this that's interesting is the whole house slave comment. He's basically Michael's referencing traditional publishing, which was a model that we all operated in operated in for decades, including Michael. So now that we've had the advent of these other options, I'm wondering why, if there are still people that decide to choose that traditional publishing as an option, and as long as it remains viable, why we have to subscribe such a derogatory term towards it. And mm-hmm. What I mean by that, and you and I, we've discussed this on this podcast a number of times, you've acknowledged that all the work that you've had to put in to distribute the Black God's War, mm-hmm. That takes a certain type of person. And not everybody's going to want to be their own marketing consultant. Not everybody's going to want to run every facet of their business. And that's what we're essentially in, is running a business here. And so to go to traditional publishing, where you have still marketing support, you still have distribution support, you still have these folks that are going to help you in a number of ways, why we're having, you know, such derogatory terms subscribed to them still is, it's interesting to me, and I'll definitely be interested to hear Michael's take on that.
Yeah, so. I think Michael and J.A. Conrath have in common that they're both, I think, this is my opinion, coming from a place of looking out for writers, for authors. You know, they're guys who have suffered the slings and arrows of being an author for a long time, and for them, a lot of those slings and arrows came in traditional publishing, and so personally, that's just my opinion, that's where they're coming from. And sometimes mm-hmm. they have kind of like offended people in the process. But, you know, I like Mike. I think he's a really good guy. That's my opinion. But I do think that, you know, his comments are understandably offensive to some people. Peter V. Brett overheard me talking about this a little bit at the banquet before the World Fantasy Awards. And he offered to sort of make a, I don't know, kind of a rebuttal of sorts to some things maybe Michael was saying. And we may have him on soon to do that. I may actually try to set up some type of moderated discussion between the two. But we're not really sure, but that's something to kind of look forward to. And this will be maybe an ongoing little subject because, you know, I think, yeah, okay, unfortunately, some people have felt raw about some of the things, some of the terminology used, for example, and maybe some of the way that things have been said. But if we get beneath that, I think we'll find a really good discussion, you know, a really good topic, because there is still, you know, we are still sussing out like what makes sense in the new age of publishing, because it is all chaos. So that's why I'm interested in having us look at this, because I think that we're going to get to some important stuff, you know, beneath the other stuff. And maybe the hidden blessing of the other stuff is that we're going to get to some important stuff here. So anyway, that's kind of the setup for that. We're going to have this interview with Michael Stackpole at the end of this, after we blab for a bit here.
I'm going to go back and reference it. I referenced it only for a moment and my thoughts about this topic, but and maybe Michael references some of the same numbers that that you reference, and maybe he doesn't, but maybe this is some of the background and what he's feeling is this whole notion of traditional publishing may be flawed because of that whole future of the bookstore conversation that you and Sean had last time. And I know there was another example we saw in the news not so long ago that the Dreamhaven bookstore that's in based out of Minnesota, it's Minneapolis, isn't it?
Yes.
Minneapolis has decided to shutter their retail space. They're going to continue to maintain their email catalog business and their online business, but they're going to shutter the retail presence because foot traffic is all but gone, I think, from what we saw from some of the news reports. And maybe that underscores some of Michael's comments. I don't know. What do you think about that, Moses?
You know, I think Mysterious Galaxy in San Diego, I think I heard they were opening another store. If I get that wrong, someone will let us know. But I didn't get to make it to Mysterious Galaxy on Wednesday night before World Fantasy Convention, but that I think that is focused on genre, right?
Yeah.
That bookstore. So I guess this gets into the topic, okay, well, what kind of bookstores could survive going forward in a world where there's an increasing percentage of the books sold are electronic? And we had talked in a previous episode, it was episode 147, and then with Joshua Bilmes in 148, about the prediction Mike Schatzkin has made about a world where 80% of the books sold for typical, fiction will be 80% ebook. And he predicts that in 2 to 5 years. Some people say that's absurd, but the rate of consumption towards ebooks has been doubling, more than doubling year after year for some time. So if that trend continues, we will hit that number. Will we or won't we? Who knows? And actually, it was neat to hear Joshua's thoughts on that in the previous episode. And he was open about why it might happen, why it might not, Mm-hmm. But yeah, as that happens, what sort of bookstores might survive? And the few things I've put together on this so far is Mike Schatzkin's article mentioned that, as we mentioned before, gift bookstores that focus on gift books and children's books, that those stores can do very well. And you're going to find out in this interview with Michael that you're going to hear in a minute if you keep listening to this episode. He talks about stores that are focused on certain communities that maybe bring in authors to have events, related to certain things. And, so those are two possibilities for bookstores that might survive and thrive, even as the world moves to, half digital or even more than half digital, which is, I think half digital is probably a safe bet in the next few years.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say the bookstores, one of the bookstores we have in Kansas City, Rainy Day Books, has become, if not nationally known, regionally known for the events they draw. And they network pretty significantly with the author community, nonfiction, fiction. They're not a genre bookstore, but they do bring in genre authors from time to time. And that has been a core part of their focus. And I attended one of their events earlier this year where they had a pitch session. And I think leading up to the event, well, one, part of the price of the admission to the event can be the book. And a lot of that's their marketing strategy, is in order to get into the event, they sell the book. And they sold, I know for that pitch session, they sold several hundred copies at that event, and had a packed auditorium at the Kansas City Library, which held about 300 folks. And so that's one thing I've firsthand seen accounts of that succeeding. And they have at least two, it seems like two events a month. So they've seen that work for years.
This is a funny thing just happened to me. Well, I got home from World Fantasy the other day, and we're driving to take our kids trick-or-treating. And my wife says, "Oh, did you hear our Barnes & Noble is closing?" And my eyes popped out of my head, and I'm like, "What?" And I was really curious immediately, well, what's the big news? And it's not that at this point there's a lot of Barnes & Nobles closing. There's three or four that they're closing this year. I just happen to be in a town where that's happening. Hmm. And, the Barnes & Noble says it's because they couldn't negotiate a good lease with the mall. The mall says it's because Barnes & Noble wasn't making enough money. I don't know who's telling the truth. So that it may just be this kind of outlier thing where like they just couldn't get some people said maybe our mall is going to go to like being an outlet mall. So maybe they couldn't get a good lease for it. You know, maybe that's it. But now that that's gone, it starts me thinking, well, what's going to happen to bookstores in my area? And you know, then you start thinking, well, maybe an independent type store will come in that will focus on things like gift books and children's books and maybe have a build a community around a certain type of readership. And all of a sudden, that's starting to make sense to me. Like, well, maybe that could work. Now, even let's say down the road, 2 to 5 years, there's something like a 50% to 80%, you know, ebook consumption out of every book made. A bookstore like that could still do fine if they diversify a little bit and focus on the right products and, you know, make a community out of it. And you know, that would be a pretty cool development if that came around. I mean, I'm really missing my Barnes & Noble already. Hmm. But, you know, there will be probably some neat things that come out of it like this too. Maybe I'm just being, you know, too optimistic, but I don't know. I think that sounds realistic.
Yeah, I think for the right niche, for the right boutique, you could create kind of a boutique business, and there certainly would be an opportunity. It just may not be on the scale that we're accustomed to seeing. Right, mm-hmm. Where we have multiple competitors that are national chains of bookstores, which so it's almost reverting back to what we saw several decades ago, where you had more of the independents, before the mall stores moved in, and that may be okay. We're just not moving. We're not moving the same kind of volume, which is what everybody's predicting. So.
Yeah, it's weird. Like, will we have Walden Books again? You know, it's like, like, well, we can't afford this big Barnes & Noble, but we can have a little bitty one.
We'll give you the equivalent that you see in the airport, basically, in the shopping mall.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me at all, you know, if that happened.
Well, it'd be interesting. Listeners, let us know what your thoughts are on this. And after you're done listening to the Michael Stackpole interview, we want your feedback on that as well, whether it's Facebook, Twitter. Leave us a voicemail on the voicemail line, which is 619-752-4737. So we definitely want to hear your feedback. Moses, any final thoughts on the topic before we jump into the interview with Michael?
Well, we did get a voicemail from Paul. Weimer. I won't mess up your last name, Paul. Even though I've heard it before, but he left us a voicemail the other day. We're not going to run it in this episode. It'll be in a future episode, but we want to say thank you to him for doing that. And, you know, echo Brent about saying that we do appreciate hearing from you guys. And we'd love to hear your thoughts on this issue. You know, what's going to happen to bookstores? Where do you see things headed with all the things we've been talking about the last couple weeks? We're going to have the winner of the Worker Prince giveaway coming up soon. That may be in our next episode. We'll see. And there may still be time, or maybe we're closed for Wookiee submissions. But if you still want to call us and sound like a Wookiee, that would be awesome too. And who knows, maybe you'll win The Worker Prince, which I have started reading and is very cool. It's a very cool book. So yeah, and then about the bookstore thing, I don't know. I'm glad to have a little bit of optimism that, oh, okay, maybe there are some good surviving bookstores that are going to be around. But since we're saying that this is going to happen because digital, you know, publishing is going to be a bigger and bigger thing, it does mean that as an author, you definitely want to think seriously about those digital rights. And that's something that Michael Stackpole is going to talk about in just a minute. And a place where I completely agree with him, which is that if you're, you know, whether you're going traditional or not, or doing a hybrid thing, you know, recognizing that that's going to be probably half the business in fiction before long, and maybe more than half, you really want to think about where you want to be and how you want to be positioning yourself in terms of ebooks. And I think you can do that with a traditional publisher. I think you can do it independently. You can do some of both. But, you know, you need to give that really, really serious thought at this point.
Good things to consider, and certainly more, I think, we'll be considering after we hear the interview with Michael. So make sure stick around after the break to listen to the segment in the interview with Michael Stackpole that Moses conducted at World Fantasy. And then definitely join us for our next episode where we'll announce the winner of the Worker Prince giveaway. And we will probably have somebody else awesome in episode 150 that either Moses talked to at World Fantasy or somebody that maybe Sean or I horse collared to talk to over the internet. So until next time, take care.
See you later.
We are pleased to have this episode sponsored by The Brahms Deception, a novel of time travel and music from Louise Marley. First, the story. Friederike Daniels, a brilliant musicologist whose life is devoid of romance, has won an irresistible opportunity to go back in time to the era of Johannes Brahms. Transported to Tuscany in the 1860s, she finds herself living in the body of the beautiful Clara Schumann and is swept into an affair with the charismatic Brahms. Rival scholar Christian North is elected to travel to the past and retrieve Friederike, who is unwilling to leave. While Christian revels in the beauty of Italy and the genius of Brahms, he is unable to unearth Friederike's deception, and it is only with Clara's help that he will be able to protect the musical legacy of Brahms and the balance of time itself. Louise Marley is an award-winning author of science fiction and fantasy and a former concert and opera singer. Her musical background lends tremendous veracity to the Brahms deception, much like it did to her previous novel, Mozart's Blood, which featured a vampire opera singer. Now, if you listen to the podcast, you know I'm not a huge fan of vampires or opera singers, but there's something about the combination of the two that really fascinates me. The Brahms Deception has been praised by Publishers Weekly, The Romantic Times, and Tor.com, sure to please fans of music and alternate history alike. To learn more, please visit louisemarley.com, and you'll also find music samples that were inspirational to the novel. Or visit our website and click on the image for The Brahms Deception.
This is Moses Sirigar with Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing at the World Fantasy Convention 2011 in San Diego, and we are doing a one-year-later visit with Michael Stackpole after our epic conversation from a year ago talking about e-books. And so I wanted to talk to you this year because over the last year, obviously publishing has changed, but your stance on publishing has changed too, and I thought it was interesting a year ago when we talked about this subject that you were still telling authors to submit to a traditional publisher first as your first option,
right.
Which surprised me a little bit at the time because I thought you would be someone saying, you know, maybe not to do that. And I know that you have your opinion has changed over the last year, and you're even getting a reputation as an evangelist at this point, you know. So how has your opinion changed over the last year then on this subject, which is, you know, natural that things would evolve?
Sure. By and large, just the events that have occurred over the last year, my feeling was that with traditional publishing, and the reason you would go to traditional publishing first is that they are the place where you can make the most money in a lump rather quickly. But several factors have changed that. One, the fact that digital is coming on a lot more swiftly means that there is money to be made today. Even if you were to sign a traditional contract today and in your advance say is going to be $10,000, you might get five today and you get $2,500 when you delivered the manuscript and you get another $2,500 when it was finally published, which would be a couple of years down the line. If you self-publish the book, you can start making money now and develop cash flow and have those things come in. And cash flow is very important to a small business. You know, if traditional publishing pays us twice a year, unless, you know, they're doing advances on a contract, mm-hmm. and you never know how much money it's going to be. So it's very tough to set up a business and work that way. Second, you had a situation with Amanda Hocking and with other authors, not as well known as Amanda Hocking, but where they had self-published on the net or they were serializing their book to the net, and that was used as a tool to build an audience, and the fact that they had established an audience was then a tool that their agents could use to sell things to traditional publishers. So since traditional publishers are concerned about whether or not we already have an audience, whether or not we're doing Twitter, whether or not we're doing Facebook, whether or not we blog, so they want us to get an audience, since publishing digitally can help us get an audience and really playtest a property and let us know and let them know whether or not this is going to be viable, now there's no reason not to go ahead and self-publish. You know, the old bugaboo of, well, if you publish it on the net, you know, they will blackball you, clearly is not true because they gave Amanda Hocking boatloads of money for her to suddenly start working for them. Mm-hmm. And that blackball thing has always been a myth anyway, but you know, now we have some very, very visible evidence that says, hey, look, you know, that's not the situation. So I, you know, that's the reason that my thinking has changed on all of this. And I have been encouraging people, you know, over the last year to just go ahead, do it yourself first, have it there, be able to collect that sales data, be able to build that audience, learn how to do the sort of publicity work you're going to have to do, even if you publish traditionally. You know, I mean, for example, I've got a book coming out in December, the second of my Crown Colonies books from Nightshade. Well, it's coming out in December, so in the end of November, I'll still take the first three chapters out of that book and serialize them to my website so that people will be getting that. And that's the same procedure I use if I'm doing a digital original or if I'm you know, doing a traditionally published book. So it's a question of authors now learning how to handle all this digital material, learning how to publicize themselves, and heck, you might as well get paid while you're doing it, and hence that's the shift.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense to me. I, you know, here at the conference, I've talked to two agents I was interested in possibly working with and an editor. I showed all three of them my book. I mean, I have my paperback book, which has been out for a few months. I showed two of them my actual Amazon page where I'm selling the book, you know, and they could see the reviews and everything. And I asked all three of them, I said, does this scare you off, you know? And all three of them said no.
Yeah,
I mean, it wasn't even a thought. It was just no. I mean, it was absolutely no.
In many ways, it's very funny because a lot of the traditional publishing attitude about these things is similar to what the traditional publisher's attitude was to if you had done gaming novels, you know, 20 years ago when I was doing BattleTech novels and those things. They would acknowledge that those things exist and acknowledge that that meant that you could finish a project, but other than that, they gave it no value. You know, they weren't looking at this as built to an audience or anything on that order. You know, now, again, they are looking for the audience, but they're not going to sweat the fact that that is out there. Because either they figure they can buy up your project or that they will hire you to do new independent material.
So that's interesting. And something that came up here at the conference, and we just discussed this briefly before we talked, is a little bit of controversy. We don't do a lot of controversy on Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, so we'll try something a little different here. I have, let me read the end of one of the blog posts you wrote on publishing, and the controversy is around the use of the term house slaves.
Sure.
And I think this little passage, it's a medium-sized paragraph and then two sort of one-line paragraphs. I think it does a good job of pointing out possibly why someone might be offended, but then also where you're actually coming from at the same time.
Sure.
So it says, and this is here I'm quoting Mike Stackpole's post. It was from, I'll pull the date up in a minute. It was from May of 2011. I know that.
Right.
I forget the actual date. So they pat your heads in that kindly manner, sweet house slave, and they tell you not to worry your pretty little head about things that don't concern you and that you couldn't possibly understand. They tell you it will all be okay and that you're safe right here with them. That's what they told you in the stateroom on the Titanic. It's what they're telling you now in the lifeboat that you're in. I messed up the last sentence, but I got the meaning right. But ask yourself, when the lifeboat starts sinking, who do you think goes overboard first? Just because you're dry now doesn't mean you shouldn't learn how to swim. And I think that shows where you're actually coming from, which is your concern for authors and telling them they should learn how to swim in the digital age. And I think that's, to me, as I read over the article, I mean, that's sort of what I came away from it with, was like, okay, I can see why some people might be offended a little bit by the use of the term and some of the way some things were said. But if they are making any attempt to read the actual meaning of what you're saying, you're trying to look out for authors and people who are writing stories and that sort of thing. So first question, were you trying to create any sort of controversy by the use of this term as you wrote this article?
Well, I don't think I, as I wrote the article, I wasn't worried about controversy. Obviously, I know that using, you know, the term house slave, and it's important that that particular blog post, the title was House Slaves versus Spartacus. You know, and the whole independent, you know, independent former slaves throwing off the shackles versus the people who are still enslaved. And so that was a lot of what I was going for there. Did I know that using the term house slaves would offend some people and, you know, kind of slap them in the face? Absolutely. But I felt that this is a serious enough issue that some people needed that slap in the face to wake them up to what was going on. So, and I know writers, you know, you get smacked in the face, you're going to get upset, and you're going to go ahead and you're going to read all this stuff so they can prove me wrong. Mm-hmm. And I felt that you know, this post, other posts that I've done, a post that Dean Smith has done, Jay Conrath, Barry Eisler, a lot of different people, when you start reading up on these issues, all of a sudden there's a lot of things that are made apparent. And what I kept hearing from a lot of authors is exactly the sort of thing that I allude to in that one of those final paragraphs, which is there are a lot of authors who are being told by their publishers, don't worry about stuff, it'll all be okay, you know, we will take care of you. And yet, when you look at the history of publishing, I mean, you know, I 5 years ago, I'd make $30,000 to $35,000 per book. Okay, now it's 10, and that's not because I'm selling any less. It's not because I've become a worse writer. That's because the market has collapsed so badly. Okay, I'm looking at the fact that prior to 2009, book contracts split profits or split income from electronic books 50-50 between the publishers and the authors. All right. Now that there's an now that there's a market for ebooks, all the contracts since 2009 demand 75% goes to the publisher and 25% goes to the authors. Why is that? You know, that makes no sense. You know, we're being mistreated in that area. And if writers aren't going to be aware of that, and writers aren't, you know, if writers are just going to say, no, it's okay, or, you know, they're going to believe all of that stuff, you know, they are the ones who are out of the lifeboat first. You know, because we are the ones that get dropped. When you think about, if you're an author, there are, you know, for every one of me, there's 100 guys that would like to take my job. There's 100 people that have got a novel that's looking for an editor who's going to say yes. Okay, and I'm probably, you know, at 100-to-1, I'm probably totally devaluing it. I mean, it's probably 1,000-to-1. So we end up being expendable. You know, instead of paying me, you know, $30,000, they can take that $30,000 and they can buy 10 first novels for $3,000 a crack and toss all 10 out of those out there. And if one or two of them hit, they win. Whereas if they give me $30,000, they have to make sure that I hit. And because sales have been dropping off, and because advances are based on 2 years worth of projected sales, if you're going to do a trilogy and they're trying to project sales 6 years out, they can't do it. So they make the logical business choice of cutting us back, dropping us, you know, acquiring works for less, hoping that one of those will hit. I understand that. That's the business model. That's what they do. But gosh, you can go into any used bookstore. You can, or you come to a convention. A bunch of us were saying that here, that, you know, we're seeing guys that we haven't seen in years. And a chunk of the reason that some of these guys are back is because they're getting on the digital bandwagon. You know, they're taking their backlist and they're putting it out there. They're deriving income from it, which we just haven't. It's really funny. A lot of authors have always said, well, look, it's always been bad. We've always been treated badly by publishers. And the point that those of us who are digital enthusiasts are saying is, that's true. We've always been treated badly. Times have always been tough. But never before have we had the outlet of going direct to our audience. You know, one of the lines that gets quoted back to me from another post that I did is simply this: just because you've lost your publisher doesn't mean you've lost your audience. And if someone doesn't want to publish you because they think the book you want to write is not going to appeal to a big enough audience, you still have an audience it will appeal to. Again, you know, one of the other analogies that has been being used here is that publishers are trimming their lines and trimming their authors as if they were a baseball team, that the only thing they want in the lineup is people who can hit home runs. Every project has got to be a home run. Well, that doesn't happen. You know, you need guys that can hit singles and learn to hit doubles and learn to hit triples. You need to be able to develop that audience. They aren't willing to do it because carrying the overhead they have, they can't take that risk. I understand that. That's part of their business model. That's the way they're going to do things. But that means then that the risk for a lot of this and the responsibility for a lot of this comes back on us authors. The other thing that I'll say, and part of the reason very definitively that I used the House Slaves remark, because I wanted to wake some people up, was this. Publishers right now give authors 25%. All right? There is a move among agents to try and drive that percentage up. At the time that I wrote that post, and it is ongoing, there are groups of individuals who are going around to authors who have a big backlist, and they are buying that backlist up at the 25% mark, hoping, waiting for that base 25% to be kicked higher because of the action of other agents, where then they go and they make their money because they've arbitraged the difference. They invest, they give you $2,000 now to buy your backlist in the hopes that a year from now the minimum royalty is going to go up to 40% and they sell your backlist off to somebody for that 40%. They're going to make their money off of that 15-point swing.
Are we talking about agents doing this?
It's agents, it is publishers, it is people who are setting themselves up just acquiring these rights, talking to widows of authors who've died and buying up their rights. You know, and I know of a number of named authors who have actually agreed to these deals because they needed money, or they don't care, or they don't think they're going to be around long enough. And so, you know, an elderly author who thinks he's going to die within a year doesn't want to worry about this, doesn't want to learn the technology, but he wants to make sure his wife or his kids or his grandkids are going to derive income. He cuts this sort of deal. And I think that those deals are morally reprehensible.
Wow. Do you know anyone that is going around buying up like this? Anyone that we can name?
No. These reports I've had in confidence. You know, I haven't run into any of them, and it's probably good because I deck them. it's just a wrong thing to be doing. And by the same token, you know, my agent has literally sent some of his authors to me for me to walk them through what the reality of digital publishing is, because they have been contacted by individuals like this. And some of the agents are so unaware. Last year at Phoenix Comic Con, I had an agent who was there come up to me at my table and start talking to me to ask me if I had anybody handling my digital rights, and she could do that for me. And it's like, honey, if you're so unaware of what's going on that you don't know where I stand, and that was after that post had been written, okay? If you haven't done your basic research, you know, then no, I don't want you touching my stuff. Not that I would anyway, but you know, and this is the difficulty, is that there's it's just a lot of chaos going on out there, and in chaos, there's a lot of fear, and a lot of authors are not touching the digital stuff because they're afraid. They don't want to learn. They don't think they're smart enough. They believe they'll be blackballed. They don't think that there'll be replacement income. They can come up with a million excuses. The problem is that this situation is going to engulf them anyway, and their willful ignorance means they can't make an informed decision. And I'm just kind of hoping with this post, and that was the first in a series of posts that were called Swimming Lessons for House Slaves. And I just went through a lot of different issues and tried to address them so people would be informed. Cool thing about this show is that, you know, while, yeah, these remarks were controversial and those people haven't talked to me, there's a lot of other people that have come up to me and said, some of them very quietly, hey, you know, thanks for posting this stuff. You know, it's really encouraging. And a lot more guys who, you know, have embraced the digital platform and, like I say, are unbelievably enthused with what's going on.
Yeah. And, you know, I used the word controversy. I don't know how big it is. I mean, I was sitting at a table with some guys the other day, and there were like two of them who said, oh, did you hear what happened on Twitter today? You know, Mike Stackpole's calling authors house slaves, and, you know, Tobias Bakel, who was just on our show,
right?
Because he completed a Kickstarter program that he was trying to pull off, you know.
Cool.
He's a friend of our show, and, he was saying something about the house slaves comment, and I think it came up just recently because it was just on J.A. Conrad's blog when Barry Eisler had a guest post, and he just had a quick reference to this House Slaves article, the one that's House Slaves versus Spartacus, May 15th, 2011. Just a quick link to it, and I guess that brought it back into the consciousness, because his, you know, J.A. Conrad's blog, of course, is one of the really big ones, especially for independent publishing. So, that stirred some people up, and so there's a little bit of Twitter talk about it right now, but I don't know how big it is. But, you know, there were a couple of people at the table who were like, that Mike Stackpole, you know, calling us house slaves. And, you know, these guys were, like, offended by that. What do you say to someone who feels that way about it?
I tell you, the truth hurts. If you're offended by it, come find me and ask me what the hell I thought I was doing. But two, you know, if you don't read the articles, if you don't understand where that was coming from, then, you know, your fury is wasted. And I think that, I can balance their fury against just the gratefulness a lot of people have had. Because, you know, I've walked them through this, and not to make myself out to be a great guy or anything like that, but, you know, I've got no reason to walk other authors through this. I've got no reason to be promoting this. It's not making me any money if someone else does digital books. You know, what's in it for me is seeing to the health of the community. What's in it for me is seeing friends who've been out of the business being able to get back in. You know, guys who've been gone for 10 years suddenly making money off of their backlist, mm-hmm. You know? I started out as a game designer, and so this is all a game to me in terms of trying to figure out how to do it well and these sorts of things. And I really want other people to be able to do this. Mm-hmm. You know, there hasn't been a single author that's come to me and said, hey, can you help me out with this, you know, where I've said, no, sorry, go away. You know, I mean, I'll always help out because I think it's very important for the health of science fiction and for the health of the industry. And again, I don't think that the traditional publishers, judging them by their actions, are on top of this problem at all. I think that, I've said in print or in blog in Electrons, that I feel that the holiday season 2011. Is the last big gasp for traditional publishing and the way things are done, and that by summer of 2012, I fully expect the flip to digital will be the main thing. And the reason for this is this, because a lot of people hear that and they say, oh, you know, so you mean, you know, by summer of 2012 we won't have physical books anymore. That's not it at all. What you have to understand from a marketing and business point of view is this. There's the concept of the qualified buyer, okay? And the qualified buyer is the buyer who comes in, wants to buy things, and has the means to buy them, okay? You know, a kid with a credit card is a qualified buyer, all right? Well, when you think about digital platform, people who like to read enough, they're interested enough in reading, that they spend $70 to $500 on a device that allows them to read, they've spent that money to basically buy an empty box. And the only way that they get value out of that empty box is to buy content for that box.
That's a good point.
And these are the qualified readers. These are the people who read lots. We've seen from all the surveys, when they get these devices, they actually read more, which means they've got to acquire more content. And this is why they're going to become the driving force in the market. Okay, that's it. These are the readers we want. These are the guys who are primed to buy. Mm-hmm. You know, they are one click away from enriching us. That's why there's got to be that focus. It doesn't mean that there won't be printed books. There will be printed books forever and ever and ever, because not everybody is going to afford a device, not everybody's going to want to drag one along. So there's always going to be a reason for having printed books. Mm-hmm. But right now, the guys who are going to be the economic engine are the ones who are embracing digital. So it's very important to make sure that we as individual authors are positioned to profit off of that. And the reason I say we're in position to profit off of that is the second thing. When publishers pay us twice a year, when they count our royalties twice a year, we never know what we're going to get. So it makes it impossible to budget. We're just not aware. Whereas when we have books that we're selling ourselves, whether it's a collection of short stories, whether it's novels you do specifically, or it's backlist novels, when we're accounting for that stuff ourselves, we get to see the trends. We get the money much faster. We have cash flow. We are now living off of that economy. We're not having our access to that economy conducted through a middleman. So if and as far as I'm concerned with house slave authors or with any authors, if all they want to do is take their backlist, they don't want to generate any new stuff, they just want to put their backlist up and make it available by themselves as opposed to having it sitting in a box, I would be perfectly happy, because that gives them access to the market, will give them money, and I think that will be great. The other thing it does is it also gives them data. Okay, I was talking to one of my publishers last night, and I said, look, we have to figure out why you guys take 6 months to sell X number of books, and I can sell that number of books of a single title in a month that I'm selling myself. We need to crack that puzzle, because they should be selling as many as I am. All right? And so those are things. But without having that data, I wouldn't know how to value what they're reporting back to me and trying to figure out what we have to do in the future.
I talked to Joshua Bilmes the other day. My interview with him will be in episode 148 on our show. But we were talking about the predictions about the possible demise of bookstores and so forth. And we were sort of looking at that two ends of it. He was saying that on the one hand, the people who are buying devices now are generally not the really dedicated readers who read a ton of books every year. And his hope on that end of the optimism scale for bookstores and traditional publishing was that if the people buying the new devices now aren't devouring quite so many books, then maybe things won't change too drastically. Some of these people, now they're going to be spending $79 for like a new Kindle, for example. So maybe they won't feel they have to spend as much money to recoup that that $79. But he said, and if I'm wrong about that, if there have been people just waiting for the prices to come down and then they're going to get the devices and then they're going to read a lot of books, then maybe things aren't going to go so well as far as bookstores' physical sales and therefore traditional publishing as it currently exists. Where do you stand on that prediction and the issue of perhaps people buying readers now are not going to be won't make as much of an impact as we might think?
Well, I think it's interesting. All the studies that I've seen indicate that the people who buy the devices are voracious readers and they increase their consumption. Mm-hmm. Okay. Second, I think Joshua's not quite dialed in on the fact, and I think a lot of publishers are not dialed in on the fact, that stories are consumables, like eggs, like milk. The fact that you can read a story again doesn't mean you will. Okay? They are consumables. If you have a hunger for that thing, once you have consumed it, you need more. All right? And so, by nature, and this is why serial storytelling works so very well, by that nature, once you've consumed that, you want the next one. You want more, all right? So you have that situation. Price points on the readers are significant, but I've been hearing projections and stuff of, when we get them below $100, when we get them below $200 or whatever, that's going to be the big tipping point. I don't necessarily think that is accurate. I think that having the lower priced items, and certainly coming into the holiday season, yes, without a doubt, the new Kindles, the new Barnes & Noble Nook, the new Sony devices, and there's a Kobo's got a new device, and there's a bunch of devices that are coming out, and I'm sure they're going to be under a lot of Christmas trees and gift giving in the holiday season. More significantly, what I've seen is a number of people who, and a lot of people are only accounting for the dedicated reading devices. The number of people I have had say to me, oh, I've got your book here on my phone.
Right.
Every smartphone is an e-book reader. All right. And we know what, you know, Apple's shipped 5 million of the new iPhone 4Ss. You know, they're projecting 15 million by the end of the year or 17 million by the end of the year. But every single smartphone out there allows you to read these books. And what I've heard people say, which is really weird, oh, I've read your book on my phone, you know, and I'm looking forward to getting an e-book reader. So these are people who are looking to buy an auxiliary device, a larger page thing to look at things. So the question is not how many of these devices do we have distributed. The question is how much awareness is there of the general population that they can read off of these devices. And when the general, you know, with you know, upwards of 60 million or more, you know, iPads and smartphones and those things, and as people replace phones with smartphones, we're going to get to the point where every single person in this country, virtually every single person in this country, will have a device that allows them to read. Now, especially valuable for science fiction and fantasy is the fact that a great chunk of those people who are coming into their own, getting those devices, and learning to read off of those devices come out of the J.K. Rowling demographic. The J.K. Rowling demographic, or the Stephanie Meyer demographic, is very, very important because these are people who have learned young that it's okay to read as entertainment. Okay, the 2008 survey of reading, the government does a survey of reading every 10 years on the 8s. In the J.K. Rowling demographic, for the first time in 20 years, we had an uptick in reading. Okay, for the you know the 13 to 15 or the 13 to 19 range, I think it was, we had an uptick in reading. So these are the kids who are better acquainted with all of these electronic devices than any of us are. They're more comfortable with them. They've learned that reading is cool. So we can begin to look for them as being people who are going to be willing to consume what we're doing. So I think that that's all upside for the whole digital marketplace. In terms of what this means for bookstores, is you have a bifurcation. Totally generalized bookstores that offer no service, okay, are going to collapse. Whereas bookstores which offer a service, which bring authors in, that teach classes, that form themselves into community centers, that bring people together, they are going to do very well. There's a bookstore in Phoenix, Arizona, the Changing Hands Bookstore, and the owner of that, in a conversation I had with her, made the comment that, in essence, that bookstore now is an event venue with a very big gift shop. And that, once you make yourself a community center, once you you know, find a way to connect with whatever your audience is, that you focus, you offer service, that when people walk in, you know, and another one in Scottsdale, Arizona, the Poison Pen, you walk into the Poison Pen and say, hey, I like Michael Connelly books, I've read all of his stuff, what else do you think I would like? The clerks can take you right to somebody and say, here it is. Bookstores like that are going to do very, very well. If you're not getting, you know, people joke about how we're a service-oriented economy, but they don't apply that to your normal brick-and-mortar stores where you are buying consumables. But service is going to make a difference, you know, and that is the key thing. But service has always made a difference in businesses, and unfortunately, large businesses tend not to emphasize service. Small boutique businesses can, because they live and die with it. And so, yeah, we'll still have bookstores, and they're going to be bookstores that serve us better than ever. And those bookstores will also learn ways to be able to distribute content from individual authors. You know, I took my digital original novel In Hero Years, I'm Dead, and I burned it to a CD. Well, that CD, I got it for a low enough price. I can afford to sell it at a discount to stores so that then they can be selling the digital book right there, and it's just in a CD in a case.
Does this mean that authors are going to need to travel more to appear at these boutique stores, you know, in their event function that you're speaking about?
I don't think they're going to have to travel more, because there are other ways that we can do events. Mm-hmm. You can do a Twitter chat. You can go into Second Life and you can do a voice chat. You can do, you know, you can use Ustream to do a video chat with your fans. So we've got ways to develop that contact and go. I think that the stores are going to be more receptive to authors showing up. So if you come into town for a convention, yeah, they may set you up to do a signing. And so I think that that's a very positive thing in that sense. Access to authors doesn't mean authors having to physically relocate. It just means you have to set up a way to get access. And you see this, I mean, I saw, before I came to the show, I saw someone sent a message down the Twitter feed that I'm on my Twitter feed saying, hey, for the next half hour, you know, at 1 o'clock, for the next half hour, I'll answer any questions that anybody's got about my upcoming book. You know, so just, you know, use this hashtag and we'll do that. And so a little impromptu chat thing, or you set it up, you know, in advance. You know, every week in Second Life, I do office hours for an hour and a half. I talk about publishing, answer questions for writers about how to handle problems and those things. So, you know, I've got a weekly contact point.
How is Second Life doing? Is it continuing to grow? Like, I haven't been on there in a long time.
It seems to be continuing to grow. I guess the economy is as robust as ever. Because I've been working a lot more, I haven't been spending as much time in Second Life as I should. But from what I understand from the people in there, it seems to be going just fine. So.
Okay, cool. You know, we could certainly talk for quite a while, but I think the limitations of the con is that.
Yeah, I've got another meeting I'm going to have to go to. So
yeah, no problem. Well, it was great to check in with you.
And, yeah, absolutely.
I'm sure we'll do it again sometime.
And I'm so enthused to find out I'm controversial. This is great.
Yeah, it was interesting, you know. And for the record, I was sitting at the table and I said, you know, Michael Sackville's a really nice guy, and he is trying to look out for authors. And, you know, that was my stance on it. And
I appreciate that.
You know, someone else backed me up on that as well. It's interesting. And, you know, he has those articles on his blog. His blog is michaelstackpole.com or stormwolf.com.
Right.
Okay. Some of these go back to May. I think the swimming lessons for House Slaves, No One Will Swim For You was another one that I found on there.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of them.
Back earlier this year in 2011.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it seems like you definitely have something you're trying to say, and a lot of people appreciate that. And, you know, and some people are bristling at the terminology, I think. And
it's a wake-up call. I mean, you know, and again, I knew that would upset some folks, but it really needed to be said to get them to start thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the critical thing. If you're not willing to think about this, you are going to be lost. And I just don't want to see anyone lost.
Yeah. And I was at your at Dragon Con this year, where you go every year, and you typically teach a sequence of sort of seminars, workshops, and I attended those and found them very useful. You do a lot of good teaching about the craft of writing, and I've always found you very helpful, you know, along those lines, as you know.
Thanks.
So that's another thing. If you ever go to Dragon Con, check out Mike there. I'm sure many other cons too, like Gen Con.
Gen Con and Origins are the big ones where I teach. Dragon Con at Origins and Dragon Con, it's Aaron Alston and I do a program. And then Aaron doesn't go to Gen Con, so it's just me at Gen Con. So.
Oh, okay, cool. All right, man. Well, thanks a lot. We'll chat with you some other time, I hope.
All right, thanks.
Please visit AdventuresInSciFiPublishing.com for show notes, videos, reviews, and more. And email us at AdventuresInSciFiPublishing@gmail.com. Some sound effects from the Free Sounds Project. Music by Asymmetry, found at musicalley.com. No authors were permanently damaged in the making of this podcast.